Welcome to the Commentary Magazine Daily Podcast. Today is Monday, June 8th, 2020. I am John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary, the 70-odd-year-old monthly of intellectual analysis, political probity, and cultural criticism from a conservative perspective. We, as always, invite you to join us at commentarymagazine.com. We give you a few free reads. We ask you to subscribe. And with me, as always, senior editor Abe Greenwald. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
Senior writer Christine Rosen. Hi, Christine.
Hi, John.
And associate editor Noah Rothman. Hi, Noah. How are you?
Hi, John. I'm well.
Good. Well, unlike the country, you are well. The country is not well. The country is reeling in two, three, four, five different directions. And I think we need to start with the radicalization of American politics that is occasioned by the move, apparently the move of the Minneapolis City Council to provide a veto-proof majority for a plan to abolish, not defund, not reorganize, not reimagine, but to abolish the Minneapolis Police Department. Minneapolis is a city of 425,000 people. It is the 46th largest city in the United States. And if its elected political leaders, not its mayor, who we saw being abused by a mob in Minneapolis for saying he was not a supporter of the abolition of the police department, though he was elected on a platform of radical change to the police department, basically being shouted down and having people scream shame, 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 like he was the naked Cersei in Game of Thrones and having to walk through the crowd home. Ordinarily, I would say, Abe, that this was an unpaid $10 billion contribution to the reelect Donald Trump campaign. But at the same time as all this is happening, the polling is just getting worse and worse and worse for Trump, which would seem to suggest a new poll this morning coming out, CNN, a 14-point margin in Joe Biden's favor, with Joe Biden at 55% and Trump at 41%, which suggests a sort of a margin of error or a cushion for Democratic and liberal and leftist craziness that makes this, I think, doubly frightening to those of us who are seeing a nightmare unfold.
So given Trump's dying popularity here, I would say that the radical moves against the police and the move in Minneapolis to eradicate the police force entirely is more like a $50,000 sort of down payment on the Trump campaign, with the rest to be delivered pending future progress. I think there still is a chance for Trump to turn this to his benefit. He's trying. He's been on Twitter over the weekend saying that Sleepy Joe will, of course, support the campaign to defund the police. He has no choice because the Democrats are run by the radical left. This is what I meant when I said a few weeks back that the conversation was going to turn from the protests themselves into an issue about which their sides would be drawn, and Trump could turn that to his advantage. He still can, I think. It's going to be very hard to come back from those kind of numbers. But I've got to believe, despite the sea of people we see supporting at least the protests, if not some of the more radical ideas that are now coming out of them, I've still got to believe that the majority of the American people would be scared to their wits of the idea of abolishing police forces in any city.
I think you're right. I do think, though, that there is clearly a shift in the national consciousness on certain types of issues, or at least a shift in what people think they are supposed to think, which is another way of looking at this, that they are telling pollsters that they are, I think, twice as likely to support the overall concept behind the protests than to oppose them, and to accept the contention that, quote, white racism, unquote, is a major problem in American life, something like by a margin of 3-2. None of that is an endorsement of radical policies, but it provides some superstructure protection, at least for the advancement of those policies, and makes them seem not quite as insane as they might have seemed otherwise, and provides Democratic politicians, again, with a little more wiggle room than you might otherwise have thought.
But can I, I think that's right, but I also think that we have to be specific about what we're talking about here, right? So you have, it's very clear to anyone who looks at this issue that the people who will suffer the most if you get rid of a police department are the people who already suffering the most at the hands of criminals. That tends to be people in poor and marginalized neighborhoods in many cities in this country. Those are, in fact, African-Americans or other minorities. So saying you're going to defund the police as a response to police perceived police brutality is a strange concept to begin with. The other thing I think, though, that we could find some agreement on, and if for those of us who know cops and talk to them, this is something they are on board with as well, the idea that the police have taken over a number of functions in our society that are actually better served by social service organizations or by professionals who deal with mental illness or homelessness. I mean, the cops are often called to deal with a social problem that isn't criminal. But if you send a cop to deal, they're trained to deal with dangerous criminal problems. They're sometimes not as well trained to deal with those more community-based things. And we can certainly do a lot more. And there has been a longstanding, decades-long movement on community policing. But I do think the one part of the defund the police argument that could be made that would reach some support is that part, to say, what do we want police officers in this country to be doing on a daily basis? You know, forget dealing with riots and looting and all the extremes we've seen in the last week. What do we think cops should do? And what is their job description? And what are the things that we are asking them to do now that they're not equipped to handle? And then we retroactively punish the police for doing what they know how to do. So I think that conversation I can get on board with, but the idea of defunding or abolishing a police department, I agree with Abe, that is not a popular argument in this country.
Okay, so I'm gonna push back on you a little bit, because I understand the argument that, of course, a social disorder problem in an individual apartment or an individual encounter with the police, why it is that a police officer who would rather not get himself in the middle of something like that is really a domestic dispute. But of course, domestic disputes can turn on a dime into something criminal. And that is essentially why in default, it has gone this way. With a change in the national consciousness again, or sort of the social consciousness about what is private and what is public. For example, until the 1970s or 1980s, there was a real issue about whether or not spousal abuse was criminal. I mean, there was certainly an issue about whether or not there was a phenomenon known as spousal rape, that within the confines of marriage, the idea that someone was allowed to withhold consent to marital relations, and that the insistence that those marital relations be observed could be viewed as an act of rape. That was not codified in the law until the late 70s or early 80s, right? So we now accept that a father using corporal punishment on a child, can be a very, very slippery slope into physical acts of abuse that are felonious. And who is going to make that determination? Somebody with a BA from a community college, who took a quiz on how to recognize the five signs of abuse. Who's going to be the one who is going to deal with somebody, on crack or something like that, who was hepped up, who has beaten up his kid or has beaten up his wife, and is just spoiling for a fight? A social worker comes to the door, knocks on the door, and says, "We hear there's trouble," and this crackhead is like not gonna go off and try to kill the social worker? Like, there is a reason that this devolved in this way, that isn't so readily changed into a social welfare approach.
Well, I mean, I agree about the criminality. In fact, there was a weird story that over the weekend where a man who was in Lafayette Square claiming, he's like, you know, I'm against police brutality because my brother was killed by the Las Vegas police, and, you know, Twitter did his thing. And it turns out, yes, his brother was killed by the Las Vegas police after the brother's girlfriend had been beaten by this man, come to the cops, begged for help. They went back to the apartment and the guy attacked the police officer, put him in a chokehold, and he ended up, you know, so he had attacked a police officer and as a response was killed. So I totally agree with that. I mean, here in DC, one of the things they try to do is have units that are both that involve cops and people who are experts in like mental health to deal with mental illness on the street. And you could see a version, a more hybrid version of policing that does bring in, you know, people who are experts at de-escalation when dealing with someone who is mentally ill. The domestic violence thing, I'm with you. I mean, that there's a reason that there's also a reason we have that they go and they arrest both people. They don't even try to figure it out. They just go and they arrest both people and take them downtown.
But this is so not the conversation that they're having anyway. I mean, this
is
none of this is about sort of what's, you know, the distinction between social work and police. This is more about the police as a concept have failed us because they are abusive and racist, and therefore they need to go. You know, I mean, and so those are really the terms of the debate.
Right. Well, so Christy E. Lopez, a professor at Georgetown Law School, has an op-ed in the Washington Post today that is a very perfect encapsulation of where the defunding the police, which is a little different from the abolishing the police standard, but not that different, where it comes from. Because she says, be not afraid, defunding the police is not as scary or even as radical as it sounds. During my 25 years dedicated to police reform, it has become clear to me that reform is not enough. Making police follow the rule of law is not enough. That's interesting, because making sure that police follow the rule of law should be enough, because that should be enough, period. Even changing the laws is not enough to fix policing. We must first recognize how much we've come to over-rely on law enforcement. That's what Christine is sort of talking about in terms of the cops themselves not really wanting to be in this intermediate role. But for most proponents, defunding the police does not mean zeroing out budgets for public safety, and police abolition does not mean the police will disappear overnight, or perhaps ever. It means shrinking the scope of police responsibilities and shifting most of what government does to keep us safe to entities that are better equipped to meet that need. Shifting most of what government does to keep us safe, okay? And here is the key paragraph, quote, police abolition means reducing, with the vision of eventually eliminating, our reliance on policing to secure our public safety. It means that recognizing that criminalizing addiction and poverty, criminalizing poverty is her phrase, as though that is actually a thing that happens, making 10 million arrests per year and mass incarceration have not provided the public safety we want and never will. The abolition language is important because it reminds us that policing has been the primary vehicle for using violence to perpetuate the unjustified white control over the bodies and lives of Black people that has been with us since slavery. Okay. So I posted a link on Facebook to a chart detailing the rate of violent crime in the United States from 1994 to 2018, which shows an 80% drop across the United States. So for Christy Lopez to claim that we are not getting the public safety that we need when violent crime has declined by 80% and has allowed for the repopulation of depopulating cities across the country, most dramatically New York City, which went from a 7 million population in 1980 to an 8.5 million population in 2019. That is insane. It may well be that you could make an argument that the crime drop had already happened and all the benefits had been accrued and that police tactics didn't change enough since the decline in violent crime to take account of the fact that policemen could stand down a little bit and didn't have to be quite as aggressively hostile or, you know, whatever toward populations of young men on street corners and things like that. Like, that's a serious conversation to have that particularly actually in smaller cities and less crime ridden places where police forces are more militarized than they need to be, way more militarized than they need to be. That again is a serious conversation that we can have. But to go from there to no police departments whatsoever is madness, but it's worse than madness. It is literally a revolutionary argument. The idea being that the understanding of public order in the country needs to be radically shifted so that we are to look at the authorities that maintain order as the bad guys, and everybody else who may or may not follow the rules as good guys.
Yeah, so it's a mistake to actually see this as an argument, in my view. it's not an argument. An argument for reform, which generated quite a lot of traction among people who were otherwise predisposed to perhaps be resistant to that notion, was wildly successful over the course of these protests. I don't think anybody, I haven't seen any responsible voices on either the right or the left, say the protests are unjustified necessarily. And polls suggest that there's a lot of support for police reform, but this is not an argument for police reform. This is an exercise in power. This slogan is subject to interpretation, and the only people who are obliged to interpret it are people who are predisposed to agree with it. And if you are not predisposed to agree with it, then you lack the requisite wisdom to engage in this debate. It is a demonstration of efficacy and a demand for a sort of supplication from people who would be otherwise resistant to the notion that, you know, radical reform is what is justified now. And it's not something that you can engage in. It's not a debate you can engage in because the terms are so malleable that and they shift depending on who's speaking and who's not. For one polite audience, to fund the police does not mean to fund the police. You know, you need somebody who's capable of interpreting this in ways that that make it much less literal. And the only people who are capable of doing that are the people who are with the program. But for audiences who are otherwise, you know, generally in agreement that the police is an abusive structure, a white supremacist structure, the language gets very literal very quick. Because they actually do mean what they say. They just don't want people who are who disagree with them and fail to flatter their vanities to engage in that argument. So this is not an exercise in creating political consensus. It is an exercise in crafting an argument around which your entry into the debate can be defined. These are the terms of your, the terms of entry, as it were, the price of the ticket of admission into a real authoritative debate. And that's purely an exercise in power. It has nothing to do with reforming the police. Reforming the police is a secondary objective. It is all about getting your adversaries to be disqualified from the public square.
Well, this is actually a really important point because I think it also applies broadly to what we saw sweep the world, actually, because we've seen protests like this in other parts of the world. And that's the difference between Black Lives Matter, the idea, all lowercase, which I think most people support, and the only people who say, oh, all lives matter, in response to that are being disingenuous. No one who says Black Lives Matter is suggesting that that doesn't mean other people's lives don't matter. So I always hate hearing that argument. But capital B, capital L, capital M, Black Lives Matters is in fact, has a platform. If you read, I went back and reread some of it over the past week. It's radical. It suggests we should, you know, abolish the nuclear family. It had, you know, for a long time, it was supporting BDS and other types of more radical notions. This is a radical group, right? And I think
that anti-Semitic the also, slogan, by the way. Literally, anti-Semitic, as we learned from the amazing tablet expose of its formation and its leadership structure.
Exactly. So there is a radical movement that is the same as a slogan that I think has brought a lot of Americans of many different racial and ethnic backgrounds together over the past week. And the distinction matters because I think what you're seeing with this debate about police is how radical smaller groups of radicals co-opt a larger sensibility that the public might have. That's a good one. Like, let's reform police. Let's fix what's broken. And I think that is something we need to continue to watch, because people aren't making those distinctions except when they need to, right? So when pressed, someone was on either CNN or MSNBC just recently asked about this. Are you really talking about abolishing the police? What does that mean if you call 911? And the response was a kind of hemming and hawing of like, oh yes, I understand that. I mean, but that's like from a position of privilege.
That wasn't just someone. I mean, that was the president of the Minneapolis City Council. Yes.
Right. Said, so she's saying,
I wondered who I would call, but I view that as privilege, which is fascinating, because who gets burglarized in the United States? You think people go and burglarize upper middle class homes that have Ring and, you know, and SimpliSafe and all of that? They don't. That's not.
Right.
It is the poor who are burglarized, and who do they have to protect them? Who do they have to throw the person in jail? Who do they have to find the goods that were stolen from them?
I mean, that's the counter to your argument, John, that you will encounter, is that, you know, the notion that the United States is a safer place than it was 25 years ago is true in the aggregate, but not for the young people of color who are subject to these kind of excessive over-policing. And there's something to be said for that, but the statistics are the statistics. They don't just reflect the conditions in white America. It's everybody.
Tens of thousands of people are alive today who would have been dead in minority neighborhoods, people of color, had the crime rate not dropped. Tens of thousands of people walk the streets today, had children, have had grandchildren, because they were allowed to live because of the change in policing. There is not a thing that the radicals here can say that can address that very salient fact. And it wasn't just the reduction in menace, which is a huge fact in making cities more livable. It wasn't just the fact that people can go out at night unmolested, even in bad neighborhoods, without, you know, fear of an encounter that would leave them robbed or beaten or something or other. It is that the murder rate and the violent crime rate dropped so precipitously that in New York City alone, there were 2,200 murders in 1991, and there were 350 last year. So take the murders, take a murder rate of 2,200 over 30 years that is cut by 80%, and then do the math. Right, in New York City alone, which is responsible for like something like 40% of the national crime drop, by the way, and New York City was not in aggregate that dangerous a city. It was, I think, the 11th or 12th most dangerous city in the United States, even at the height. It's just that it was so big. It's so much bigger than other cities that the aggregate numbers were larger. You are talking about 25,000 people in New York City alone who were alive who would probably otherwise have been dead.
One of the most truly frightening and maddening aspects of what's happening right now, though, is that not only are we not hearing actual arguments, as Noah said, but the idea is almost that to bring up statistics, however convincing, to talk about the numbers is condemned as kind of indecent, right? You're giving me facts and figures and numbers. We're talking about lives. We're talking about families. We don't have people we know. We're talking about lived experience. That's not entirely beside the point either, but it is becoming so that there is literally no room for statistics in an argument about crime and policing. And
no, there is. There's plenty of room for it as long as it demonstrates the extent to which police forces have become abusive. Those statistics are welcome in the debate because it is an exercise in power, in right think.
But the statistics don't tell that story. That's what's interesting about this.
Most complaints are made against young African-American males, which is absolutely the case.
No, but here's what I mean. What I mean is that what has driven this emotional movement to, you know, take over the streets of the city and change opinion about it are anecdotes, our visual anecdotes, our videos, and you know, horrible individual stories involving an infinitesimal fraction of this almost 700,000 peace officers in the United States, right? So, and yet I think everybody acknowledges that these are matters that have to be addressed and taken seriously, in part because of the emotional effect that they have on everybody, and the fact that you can't bear to see stuff like this happening, and the fact that, you know, people who are given the right to practice violence, the only people in the country who are sort of assigned the duty of controlling their own violent actions in this way, because we empower them to use violence judiciously to protect everybody else, that is intolerable and unacceptable when it emerges to the surface. Now, you can then either say, well, this happens every day and no one's ever seen it before, and only in the last 5 years has this come up. Or you can say it's still an infinitesimal number, but dealing with the infinitesimal number of cases is important because we don't want the public feeling as though the police are the bad guys, or the police are the enemy, or that safety is being bought at a cost of the humiliation and mistreatment of an entire population.
What frustrates me is that the right is perceived to be, by those who are engaging in this debate, as hopelessly out of touch, in part because they don't entertain these theories of community policing and the abolition of police forces and the reimagining them as being a viable option. And therefore they need to invite people who do into the discussion and at least take all these notions very seriously. And that's what I'm talking about. If you don't do that, you're disqualified from the public square. And what's needed now is somebody to say that this is absolutely insane, completely crazy, unworthy of discussion in a responsible setting. Everybody seems afraid to do that. There are consequences for doing that when it seems pretty plain on its face that we don't have any polling to this effect, but we will soon. And my understanding of society, the society that we live in, and something that's intuitive, is that people are not going to react well to the notion, literally understood, that you should defund and abolish police forces. That seems like something that everybody should get intuitively. And you have to talk yourself into not getting it. You have to entertain these theories and chin stroke and say, well, you know, maybe there was this other, you know, there's a city that experimented with this sort of thing and it had X, Y, and that's completely beside the point, because this is not an exercise in talking about reform. Reforms that will actually be implemented.
Okay, I need to pull back because I need to talk to you guys about our first sponsor today, ExpressVPN. So ExpressVPN is a way of making sure that your web searches remain entirely your business, right? And so we've all had the experience of wanting to look up something that we wouldn't necessarily want anybody else to know that we looked up. And generally speaking, people who are concerned about this will maybe go to their browser and go to incognito mode and search something. But let me tell you something, incognito mode does not hide your activity. It doesn't matter what mode you use or how many times you clear your browsing history. Your internet service provider can still see every single website you've ever visited. That's why even when I'm at home, I never go online without using ExpressVPN. Doesn't matter if you get your internet from Verizon or Comcast or whoever else. ISPs in the United States can legally sell your information to ad companies. ExpressVPN is an app that reroutes your internet connection through their secure servers so your ISP can't see the sites you visit. ExpressVPN also keeps all of your information secure by encrypting 100% of your data with the most powerful encryption available. Most of the time, I don't even realize I have ExpressVPN on. It runs seamlessly in the background and is so easy to use. All you have to do is tap one button and you're protected and it's available on all your devices, your phones, your computers, even your smart TV. So there's no excuse for you not to be using it. So protect your online activity today with the VPN rated number one by CNET and Wired. Visit my exclusive link, expressvpn.com/commentary, and you can get an extra 3 months free on a 1 year package. That's expressvpn.com/commentary, expressvpn.com/commentary to learn more. Now, Noah, the one thing I want to differ with you on, and then we can move into to another topic near and dear to our heart over the last couple of days, is that if this is an effort to, you know, sort of like express dominance or, you know, power, intellectual movement, procedural power, one of the reasons it works so efficiently is that the liberals in the movement, in the general American political divide, are uniquely ill-defended by their own side against the arguments of the more passionately driven people on the left. And as always the case, being pulled to the left. But what we've seen over the last week, and particularly at the New York Times, but also at the Philadelphia Inquirer and various other places, is the Bolsheviks overtaking the Mensheviks, or the liberals being overrun by the radicals, or the radicals on campus in the 1960s attacking not, you know, William F. Buckley Jr., but their own liberal professors who mostly agree with them, but, you know, would perfectly rather think that, you know, life as it's going on is okay, except for all the bad guys on the other side. But, you know, they're largely with you, and they just, you know, maybe tactics need to be viewed. So basically, James Bennett, the editorial page of the New York Times, is out after committing the thought crime of having his people commission and publish a piece by Senator Cotton of Arkansas. We went through this on Friday. But what is fascinating is the nature. He quit nominally. He was fired, almost certainly in actuality, because the people, the radicals on his staff, who announced that the publication of this op-ed would endanger the lives of Black people and endanger their lives and was evil and shouldn't be heard. And
which Ben Smith at the Times, who does sort of an ombudsman job over there now, identified through his reporting as originating with the guild that represents these staffers, many of whom objected. And the language that they used was protected speech because it referred to workplace endangerment. And that's why they used the specific phrase that they used, that this op-ed endangers the lives of Black New York Times reporters, because it is something for which you can't be fired for saying.
Interesting. Okay, so what we have is James Bennett desperately trying, beginning on Thursday afternoon, to keep his job, first by invoking the great world in which liberals, you know, accept hearing the opinions of people with whom they differ so terribly. But that's all part of the job. And then saying, no, we shouldn't have published it at all because it was full of factual inaccuracies. Of course, there were no factual inaccuracies. So that was a really craven thing to do, was to blame Cotton and his staff for having written something false. And then they shouldn't have published it. And then they apologized again. And then by yesterday afternoon, Sunday afternoon, Bennett was out. This also, at the same time, our old friend Barry Weiss had done a little tweet storm about the difference in approach between people who were so offended by the Cotton op-ed that they couldn't see straight, and people who had a different approach, even if they didn't like it. And for this, she was pilloried within an inch of her life for not taking their pain seriously enough or something like that. And
what that statement was, by the way, and reflects the anti-intellectual nature of this movement, is simply a restatement of the thesis in Lukianoff and Haidt's book, The Coddling of the American Mind, almost verbatim, a restatement of a New York Times bestselling book, which a lot of people apparently have not read and really need to, because they had inadvertently confirmed its thesis with the reaction.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, yeah, so she had done, but yeah, well, right now, if John Haidt, you know, gave a speech in front of, if there were any students at NYU and he gave a speech at NYU about this stuff, you know, he would be, you know, they would come after him with pitchforks. So just because John Haidt says he's a liberal and he teaches at NYU and everything should be fine, you know, God knows what it's going to be like for him in September.
But can I offer a slightly cynical observation here, which is that for those of us who've been following particularly institutions like the New York Times for years, it's dramatic because of the fact that someone, you know, in a position of power lost their job over it. But it's basically just saying out loud what a lot of the journalists who work there have been doing kind of under cover of our objectivity, right? So the Ben Smith piece had an interesting quote from a journalist who said, you know, now we can have moral clarity. It's like now we've kind of come out as you know, self-identifying, not as journalists who pursue objective facts and try to, you know, convey to the public what's going on in the world. We are going to be beacons of moral clarity. That's a different job. That's usually how you would describe, say, a job if you want to be a preacher, for example, not a journalist. But now this has become
or an op-ed columnist.
Sure, but not a journalist. Yeah. It's a different thing. Opinion journalism is not the same thing as you know, a reporter's job who's, you know, following a candidate.
So the Mr. Bennett's replacement. The new editor of the editorial page of the New York Times told staff, or op-ed page rather, told staff, quote, anyone who sees any piece of opinion journalism, headlines, social posts, photos, you name it, that gives you the slightest pause, please call or text me immediately. That seems very, like she's going to have
please
a very
enjoy.
Terrible time in her new job.
If you see something and feel something, say something, right?
Like, yeah, it is. If you see something, say something. This is, you know, this is like if you see a suspicious package,
if you see a suspicious thought,
call 911. You know, if you see a suspicious sentence on Twitter,
and that is precisely this spoken. Is precisely what Barry Weiss had said in that so offensive tweet storm, that this is a reaction to what Hayden Lukianoff calls safetyism, which is a perception that your discomfort is something that you should be able to address through complaints to authorities structure.
Okay, but Abe, let's be real here. Hayden Lukianoff were being emotionally generous. Barry was being emotionally generous. None of this is about really addressing people's fears of fears of triggering or whatever. This is just raw. This is the use of safetyism as a revolutionary lever to destroy people you don't like, to get them removed and to take over from them. No?
Yes. And it's why I've always hated the term snowflake, because snowflake implies that, like, you know, some liberal who's will be offended by scary ideas will sort of melt in fear of them, which is not at all the case. All these sort of campus snowflakes throughout the decade, what they are really about is getting people fired.
That's a great observation. That term implies fragility.
Yes,
where
right.
It doesn't exist.
Exactly.
It's not fragile at all. It's very extroverted and very aggressive.
When someone screams at someone else, as has happened to me a couple of times during the lockdown, for example, when, you know, if you were walking 15 feet away from somebody, no one else was around you, you're walking, you weren't wearing a mask, and you were 15 or 20 feet away from someone, and someone would scream at you from a park bench, put on your mask, I'm terrified, right? In other words, when someone shouts at you and says, you're scaring me, are they scared? You yell, I'm scared at someone who's frightening you? No, because if you were actually frightened, the last thing you want to do is call attention to yourself. This is saying, I am beating you up in the guise of pretending that I'm not beating you up. And so, yes, on campuses, they're being fired. Now, here's the best part about this in terms of schadenfreude, which is this is the crisis of liberalism, which is that it is toothless, that it is self-aware, loving and self-righteous and full of finger wagging at the bad conduct and bad behavior of others. But when the, and so as a result, when the canonry is turned on the liberals, all they can do is sue for peace, because they act as though the world of argumentation or the world of power is something that, you know, they really are beyond. They're beyond all of this. And it's only you crude, you know, Neanderthals who think that, you know, sweet reason can't rule everything. You know, it's only you morons and idiots and who don't like science and don't like this and don't like that. We can all have a conversation. As long as we accept certain priors, like Trump is evil, then we can all have a nice conversation. You know what? When revolution comes, they get eaten first. We don't get eaten first. And they're like, what are you doing? I'm with, you know, it's like that video of the guy in the, you know, that guy in his apartment who gets a rock. You saw this last week during the protests, and the rock is thrown through the window of his apartment. He's like yelling out of the window, hey, we're with you. We're supporters of you. We support you. So that's supposed to inoculate you. You're like, oh, it's really your concerns about policing and what systemic racism. I mean, that's really so meaningful to me. And I you know, thank you very much. And here I'm going to publish 27 op-eds saying everything you want to hear. And I'm publishing one op-ed over here by somebody else, but you get 97% of the coverage is the way you want it. I got one piece over here. Don't worry about it. It's like, oh yeah, you think you got one piece? You are fired, man. You're dead, and anybody who follows you is dead. And if you publish an op-ed that says buildings matter by your architecture critic, you're going to lose your 20-year job at the as the editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer, and everybody else in journalism, you're on notice. You're on notice. We're getting you. We're going to have people call you, and you're a dead man.
Another thing that's been frustrating me is in the policing of discourse and the exercise of power under the guise of having a debate is there is a notion abroad now that if you are at all concerned about the conduct of the New York Times editorial page at this late date, you know, having gone through this for the better part of a week with, you know, this thing exploding over the weekend, if you're still talking about this, you are truly elitist, truly out of touch. Have no understanding of the concerns of normal people. Who even reads the New York Times editorial page? Say the people who write for the New York Times editorial page. It's again, it's an exercise in power and something that makes the left look pretty bad to neutral observers, you know, dispassionate sort of outside the spectrum observers. Certainly this is something that we get to talk about because we write opinion for a living and that's just what we do and we're very interested in it and we should be interested in it, and go screw yourself if you think we shouldn't be interested in it. However, this is something, obviously, the way you framed it, John, everybody should be interested in it. It is not about the New York Times editorial pages. It's about society.
Look, this is when people started talking 6 or 7 years ago about Twitter mobs, right? About social media mobs. And it's so terrible because it's making teenage girls feel terrible. And Twitter mobs go up, but, you know, and they're, you know, they chase people who have no recourse. Justine Sacco, this one and that one. It's just awful what happens, and it's terrible, and everybody should stop, right? That was a sort of general understanding of conventional opinion. That's not the lesson. It's not the lesson of the Twitter mob or the lesson of the 2010s. The lesson is do it twice as hard. Keep doing it. If you're Chapo Trap House, you're getting $2 million a year in GoFundMe money. If you're, you know, if you're the dirtbag left, this is your moment. If you're an anarchist, if you're like Antifa, go into the streets. No one's going to arrest you anymore, or they'll arrest you.
This is the terrible lesson that everybody has to internalize now, and I tremble at this realization, but it's one that has become inescapable. Just as the lockdown orders are enforceable only as long as your crowd is small enough to disperse, conservatives and people with heterodox opinions in these institutions need to realize that the only thing that's going to keep you safe is the Powell Doctrine here. The slightest sign of insurrection needs to be met with overwhelming, absolute force, every institution, every voice you could possibly muster in order to demonstrate a show of force and efficacy in numbers. It's a numbers game now. It's all about raw power, not institutional rules, not norms.
So take James Bennett. So he hired Bret Stephens and Barry Weiss, conservatives who were anti-Trump. He has Ross Douthat on his staff, who was there before he joined, who is a conservative who is anti-Trump. And his argument, good liberal argument, would be, look, I'm trying to help America by giving space to this argument so that, you know, when the fever breaks and everything, you know, they're going to help the fever break. They're going to help take Trump down. And then we can go on to something new, right? Because they're conservatives, but they don't like Trump. Well, guess what? The people that he is attempting to sway with this idea, they don't care whether they like Trump or they don't like Trump. That doesn't matter a whit to them. What they want is James Bennett's job. They want Brett's job. They want Barry's job. They don't want, you know, oh, this is really good. You're building a coalition, an intellectual anti-Trump or, you know, post-Trump coalition. They want it all for themselves. And the argument is that, you know, the very fact that you entertain ideas about other things aside from whether Trump is or is not unfit for office, those ideas are just as bad as Trump. Everything you think is as bad as Trump. Anything that isn't what we say at any given moment is evil.
And we're all right. So not only do they not care if these conservatives are anti-Trump, to the extent that there is any ideological thinking that goes into this, there is no such thing as a decent conservatism to them anymore, right? It's akin to it. That would be like saying, well, there are good fascists. I mean, that is where they're at. And that is why the outrage is so instant and overwhelming every time.
Right. And that's why I made the Menshevik-Bolshevik comparison. Because, of course, what did the Mensheviks have to do the minute that they got into power? What did the Bolsheviks have to do? They had to kill off them or drive the Mensheviks away. Because there's no common cause to them. Even if the Mensheviks swear fealty, their disease, they have an original sin. They weren't with you from the outset. And whatever, however they kowtow, you still can't trust them. And if you, by the way, if you don't kill them in 1919, you kill the remnant in 1932-33 while you're purging everybody who was with you. Because that's the other thing that's going to happen. So let me pull back again, because I want to talk to you about our second sponsor, Tommy John. Not the surgery, the underwear. Because Father's Day can be stressful trying to find the perfect gift for dad. Thankfully, Tommy John, the revolutionary underwear and clothing brand, knows that comfort is for everyone. Yes, even your dad. So give him the softest, most breathable base layer he's ever worn. Their new and improved men's underwear is now twice as durable as his current pair and infinitely more luxurious, guaranteed. Plus, Tommy John is offering their best Father's Day deal ever with 25% off site-wide, including easy-to-gift sets that you can order straight from your phone directly to dad's door. I'm wearing it right now. It's fantastic. My kids are probably not going to buy me Tommy John underwear because I already have some. But if you're looking for something, honestly, it is something special, and so are the, like, the sort of pajama bottoms and the t-shirts. So treat dad to a few pairs of Tommy John underwear in the softest, most breathable fabrics he's ever worn. All the layers are built for next level comfort, whether you're on the hunt for lounge pants, lazy day joggers, or the softest Zoom ready tees and polos you or your dad has ever worn. Tommy John has you covered. Remember to get your order in before June 17th to ensure that your gift arrives for Father's Day. Tommy John is so confident in their underwear that if you don't love your first pair, you'll get a full refund with their best pair you'll ever wear, or it's free guarantee. Tommy John, no adjustment needed. Tommy John has the perfect gift for all the dads in your life. Deliver comfort to dad's door with 25% off site-wide at TommyJohn.com/commentary. That's TommyJohn.com/commentary for 25% off site-wide. See site for details.
Can I ask a question / rant? Yeah. One of the other dangers that is ahead of us with regard to, you know, your Bolshevik-Menshevik comparison here is the use of history. So, I mean, we saw a little glimpse of this over the weekend when Mitt Romney posted a picture of himself in D.C. Marching and said Black Lives Matter. This prompted a whole discussion. You know, a lot of people on the left sort of praised him and also denied that, you know, he had been pretty unfairly attacked when he was a candidate. But we also see this in, you know, we've talked about the 1619 Project. We see a need in order to consolidate power in the way that it's being consolidated in some of these institutions. You have to be able to explain away facts that don't fit the narrative that helped you consolidate power. So we see a lot of this. I mean, in a small relief, we see this with the way that some of the rioting and looting has been explained by people on the left who'd rather just not would rather pretend it didn't happen or justify it. We see this in small ways, you know, with how history is used in a very instrumental way to justify kind of sweeping proposals now. And I think going forward, we're gonna see a lot more of this. And that, I think, is, if you're coming from the conservative side of this, we need to stay very focused on the politicization of history happens by all sides. That's, I'm not pretending that conservatives are innocent in that regard. But I do find that the way in which institutions like the New York Times in particular have done this so successfully is worrisome going forward. Because even after Trump is out, this is going to remain a problem. Even after they don't have Trump to focus their anger on, they will find other ways to manipulate the past to suit a narrative now that helps a political agenda, not understanding.
Oh, we saw some of this in over the weekend in London, where you had protesters defacing statues like Winston Churchill and Abraham Lincoln. Now, you can make a case that Winston Churchill was a noxious colonialist. I mean, that's a very popular case on the left. But nevertheless, you know, it sort of strikes at the heart of your anti-fascist notion. But what the heck did Abraham Lincoln do? I mean, are they are Londoners really mad at the suspension of habeas corpus during the Civil War? This is not a movement that has some sort of intellectual buttressing. It's just an expression of rage.
Yeah, and if you want a more peaceful police force, they often hold up the UK police, who don't always carry a sidearm. During the riots, they were not in a great position. There were some really awful footage of them having stuff thrown at them and chased away from.
Yeah. Traced away, yeah, exactly. But which is why you maybe don't want to disarm the police, because then they can't defend themselves against an angry mob. But also, again, you know, these worldwide demonstrations against one episode of American police brutality, I doubt it. I really doubt it. I mean, it's part of it, and it's part of its domestic as well, especially in the case of France, where they had this 4-year-old case that was the result of, you know, that expression of anger over this 4-year-old case. Yeah, sure. But really, it's just all about the lockdowns.
Well, it's also about hating America. I mean, this is a new version of the, you know, the.
Yeah, there's a lot of nuclear freeze in this as well.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, you can't just, you know, discount that, which is that the left in these countries hates America. They hated America before Trump. They'll hate America after Trump. They don't care about, they don't care at all a whit about George Floyd or what goes on in Minneapolis. It's of no interest or concern to them whatsoever. So. Now let's take 3 minutes to talk politics here, because you know, in an ordinary moment in time, if you were, you know, hanging around the stairs around the down to Joe Biden's basement as part of the Biden brain trust, ordinarily you would be terrified by what's going on here. That you have literally a democratic city in the United States that is on the verge of at least theoretically abolishing its police department in a state that Hillary Clinton only won by a point and a half, that if it went, you know, Republican, I think it's 10 electoral votes, you know, your task becomes that much harder. And yet, I don't know, looking at this polling and stuff like that, I just don't, I'm sure that, you know, old hands look at this and say, this really can't be very good for us. But the polling is not suggesting that Trump has been making up any ground on his decline over the 10 days of riots, which I don't think any of us would have anticipated. I think we would have thought that there would have been a kind of
I anticipated it.
Safe.
I didn't. Oh, okay. I didn't think he would benefit from this. He is perceived to be, by more voters than not, an agent of chaos at a time of maximum chaos. He has made cases for himself that he cannot meet. He has suggested that he will be this force for order, and he can deploy forces to encourage and recreate order when he cannot do that. He is legally not obliged to do that, which is alienating some of his core supporters, because they expect more from him than he can deliver based on what he's saying to them. So I didn't expect him to benefit from this. Republicans still have the capacity to benefit from this if they were to find a state level a governor, apolitical, state level, around which they can rally and make the case for law and order, because they, governors, actually do have the capacity to impose this kind of policing from the top, and the president cannot. They might be able to make a successful case for themselves if Democrats really go off the deep end and really start indulging what the radical fringe and on their side wants to do. But you also haven't seen a whole lot of Democrats do that. You've seen many very, very prominent and influential voices, and they might be the wave of the future. I bet they are. But what the House Democrats introduced today in terms of legislation is nowhere near that radical, and not something that I don't think you can say is an abdication of their responsibility to be forces for civilization as well as reform. So we just haven't gotten to that place yet. But I don't anticipate Donald Trump will benefit from this. The perceptions of him are long ago baked into the cake.
Well, again, so what does it mean if if the CNN poll is, you know, an accurate reflection of reality, and he's at 41 and Biden is at 55? So 41 is about where he is in polling, right? 41, 42, 43, something like that. So that means that there isn't very much slippage. What it does mean is that everybody else in the country has decided they don't like him anymore.
Well, and it's...
I mean, that's the only way to look at it. That's 90. That poll comes to 96%.
And he's actively harming his own brand, if you want to look at it in that, you know, instrumental way. Because he's, I mean, what is it? Speak softly and carry a big stick. That's the kind of, you know, there's a kind of American swagger of leadership that's like that. He speaks loudly and doesn't actually have the power to wield the stick. So he just looks at worst impotent, and at best sort of desperate. I mean, it's not a great look. And I think that's where you see conservatives, and also the use of federal power and his getting the military involved in how he's talking about this hasn't helped. I think he thought that was a signaling to his people who would, you know, who like law and order. They like the military. He's thinking in abstractions in a way that's really unhelpful at a time of a specific unrest.
Well, so there's talk that he's going to make a speech on race.
You got to be kidding me.
No. Okay. The administration is seriously considering his giving a speech on race.
Cool. Will Jared Kushner write it? Because then it'll go really well. Because, you know, what I think about sensitivity and bringing the country together, right, on race, I think about Jared Kushner, who, you know, it's really something it's a vineyard that he's labored in.
But this is what's going to get really nerve-wracking, because Donald Trump needs to change the game, and he needs to change it in a dramatic way and very soon. Right. And they're all thinking along those lines. And if that's what they're going for, and they think that they have to do that, what else will they convince themselves they have to do?
I don't think it's a terrible idea if he were to give a speech on race that reflected what we talk about, right? Like, I think if you hit the sweet spot of saying there's something very serious that's gone on here, sometimes it appears, you know, we've all gotten a sort of education in what, you know, the excessive use of police force can lead to, and we can all move on from here together if we can find a consensus. But a world in which we're talking about abolishing police is a world in which the country is descending into the madness that gripped it in the 1960s and 1970s, and we cannot go back there again. I don't think that
we've made this mistake for 3 years thinking that what the president, that's not in the president's heart.
I know
he
that
he will not stick to that. The script.
I know. I'm saying, could he do it? Yes, he could. Well, you know, desperation makes can make change, but the other reason I think that there is a unique kind of danger to him right now is these poll numbers, if they reflect anything that they're seeing also, and basically this puts Biden up over 50% in the Real Clear Politics average, means that he's up about 8, something like that, is that it gives Biden more running room also. Like this sense that Biden needs to be really delicate and like not shatter his coalition by saying things like, I do not want to defund the police. If he's up 12, 13, 14 points, and what he really needs to do is solidify those people who are moving toward him, who are precisely the suburban mothers who are going to stake in the heart of Trump, And he is being given leeway to move to the center on this issue.
He would have to abandon his own white papers at this point. His campaign has called for increased funding of local police departments.
Right. So what I'm saying, So there you go. So I'm saying that in an odd way, it's not that he would use this as a sister soldier moment in the sense that he wouldn't have to go out and say, you know, here's a terrible rapper who was calling for the murder of white people, and that's just awful. All he has to say is, he has to say what Jacob Frey, the pathetic mayor of Minneapolis, said when they started, you know, when they started shaming him, making him do the walk of shame, is, I do not believe in abolishing the police. He could say, you know, as Obama said, the overwhelming majority of police officers are good people who do good things for the country. And yes, and for all you know, then, under those circumstances, the dirtbag left and these lunatics like Chrissy Lopez of the Georgetown Law School and all of these disgusting people who spit on the people who helped save this country from the crime spiral that had made it descend into a dystopian nightmare that I grew up in. What are those people going to do? They're going to trash Biden? Fine, let them trash Biden. Like, how many divisions do they have?
Trump will probably just have Kanye come give the speech on race, you know, just sort of.
I wonder if Kanye would do that. Who knows? No, I mean, Biden can do a 3-hour speech about everything that's evil and horrible in race relations, and all he has to do is speak this one sentence. Because, of course, I don't think that we should defund or abolish the police. Police do many good things. That's all he has to say. That's the only sentence that will matter. And again, if he loses 2 or 3% of his support among, where are they going to go? I mean, that's always, are they going to go to the libertarians? Because the libertarians are, that would be interesting, a sort of radical African-American, you know, socialist move to the Libertarian Party. They're going to go green after what happened with Jill Stein. They're going to try to help get Trump reelected with Jill Stein. I don't know. So we were going to be talking about the New York Times editorial page editor resigning in their COVID bingo.
I did not have that one in my bingo card.
How about in their riot bingo? No? How about their looting bingo?
By the way, I've been harping on this point for a week, but I still get angry when people downplay the long-term consequences of the looting, in part because I'm still looking, you know, I still take walks in my neighborhood every day, and lots of people in New York have this experience too. And it's true that everything was calm. And we had a massive demonstration here on Saturday that was largely peaceful, and, you know, people behaved. It all went really smoothly, which was very nice to see. But every single storefront still boarded up. And that is going to take a mental toll, an emotional toll on people at a time when we're once again being reminded to stay at home again, because, oops, you know, as if the last week didn't happen in terms of protests. So I think, again, like in terms of how people are feeling about the direction this country is going, there's going to be, you know, there's a lot of anger last week, and now there's going to be a lot of confusion setting in.
And especially in New York, because stores are still boarded up here too. And today is the first day of our phase 1 reopening.
No, I mean, the stage is set for a real significant backlash among people who don't destroy property and don't gather in large numbers and are employed in the day and can't protest. And I mean, that's there, but I don't think it manifests in this cycle. I think it manifests in the next 2 or 3.
Well, I mean, think about the craziness of this year. I mean, you know, we are really, not since 1968 has there been a year this crazy, because we had, the president was impeached, remember.
Nah.
In this year, he was was impeached, and then there was this virus, and then there was this economic meltdown, and 40 million people lost their jobs, and then there was this rioting, and then there was this looting, and it's June 8th.
Yeah, hurricane season is just beginning.
Yeah, there's totally room for
so
one
normal
mass
natural disasters. Yeah. We haven't had a big one yet, you know.
That would be a comforting return to normalcy,
right? So with that, we will bid you adieu until tomorrow. For Christine Rosen, A. Greenwald, and Noah Rothman, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.